Harry Constable in his own words. Episode 3. Walks through the East End.
By the time I was 9 years old, I had travelled extensively in London with my father. Some of our travels had taken me as far as Hampstead Heath. Little of our travelling was done by public transport, though. My dad mostly preferred to walk. He had worked in and around the West End of London and the city. He knew his London and made every effort to teach me what knowledge he had acquired. Breakfast on most Sundays in our house would start with a large piece of salt fish with bread and marge. If Dad was taking me for a walk, Mum would cut a few sandwiches of cheese or beef dripping to sustain us for the day. We would set out only after Mum had attended St. Patrick's Church.
Prior to the 1914-18 war, some traders in Wapping had banded together to operate in small groups, creating their own laws and customs. They operated as guilds without guild status. Some were trades of long standing, such as fish markets, meat markets, pawnbrokers, jewellers, farriers, and many other well-known trades, the objective being self-preservation.
When we moved from Wapping to Poplar around 1925, this system of trading still existed. It was a way of life, pleasantly organised, and with it, people felt comfortable. Suddenly, this was to change. Your favourite butcher was priced out by a combine as the long-established traders were taken over and new names appeared. This created new situations that the older folk resented. They protested at being deliberately pressurised, and this added to social unrest. Then, without warning, we were given a few signs of things to come. The pirates had arrived on our main roads.
Here we must explain. Pirates came in the form of buses. The transport system in the capital operated very well. The buses were governed by controls with reasonable fares and bus stages with regular stops. Tram cars were governed by the local authorities. Suddenly, these pirate buses appeared and caused quite a stir. We were introduced to a new form of intensified private enterprise. At first, it was accepted as progress. Some saw it as a novelty. But within a few months, the free enterprise venture began to take its toll.
Buses from some companies, Atlas and Premier, to name but two, were dangerously overtaking other buses and pulling into stops where many would-be passengers had gathered. Some of these buses caused accidents. People were hardly on or off the bus and the bus would pull away, sometimes not stopping at regular or request stops where there were only a few people. Passengers were alarmed and the public outcry became an all-London protest and people demanded action.
The government withdrew its support from these get-rich-at-any-cost owners and they were forced by local councillors and London County Council to reconsider their transport policy. Harry and his dad continued their travels on foot.
Dad and I would make our way through Wapping High Street past the Tower of London. Everywhere was silent, but at intervals the church bells would peal loud and clear on both sides of the river. We'd stop by Traitor's Gate, waiting for the Bow Bells to call. The Tower of London is the boundary between the City of London and Wapping and was the place where Hanging Judge Jeffreys was captured by the people and taken to the Tower to get his just desserts. That was at Wapping Old Stairs. When the bells stopped, the silence was more intense than ever. The river across Tower Bridge at such times as these always appeared unreal and fascinating. Walking on in Lower Thames Street, with its Billingsgate Market, one would never believe that this was the same place that we saw on working days, when Billingsgate was Bedlam. The trains rattling across the bridges on the river were to me something awe-inspiring. The first time we got to Westminster Bridge and could see Big Ben and the statue of Boadicea in her chariot, Dad told me how she helped to drive out the invader from Britain. He told it somewhat different to our school books. Dad didn't like Hyde Park and Battersea Park. Hyde Park, he said, only looked anything like a park when the sheep were grazing and when the orators were in full flow. He firmly believed that the authorities allowed the speakers there to say what they wanted to say so the police would enter their names in the books at New Scotland Yard and keep them for future reference. He'd say that the whole business of permitting speakers to have their free say also created an illusion among overseas visitors who would go home and tell their folk that they had witnessed real freedom of speech in England. There were parks my father was very fond of. He had much praise for St James's Park. The ducks swimming beneath the bridge and the shoals of small fish were a great attraction to him. His comments on Buckingham Palace were brief and to the point and not very complimentary. He was a hard and fast Republican. I never saw him buy food for himself when out walking, but he would buy a drink or a pie for me if I had eaten the food that Mum gave us. Maybe he would have enjoyed life more if he could have spent more freely on food and the small luxuries of life.
Often, when Harry went out with his dad, he would wonder why his dad would ask him to read notices. In later years, Harry learned his father was dyslexic. His mother never let on to the children until many years had passed. It was then that the puzzle was solved.
Before we moved to Poplar, I was aware of the Jewish population in the East End, but their presence never meant anything special. They were part of the East End. I knew that Jews had been persecuted in their homelands and they had sought asylum. Having moved to another part of the East End, I began to realise acutely that there were many more people of different nationalities who had sought asylum. It was a totally different East End to the one where I was born.
The names over the shop were hard to pronounce. They were more difficult to spell. Although some Jewish businessmen became very rich, there was great poverty throughout their community. Jews had lived in London for centuries. Persecution in Poland and Russia brought the Jews to London, at first in small groups, and then in a flood towards the end of the 19th century and in the early part of the 20th century. A high percentage of Whitechapel people were either refugees or descendants of immigrants from Europe. These people landed at Wapping.
My friends told me the Jewish experience of their ancestors, generations back, when their people came ashore and were met by police officers. This, obviously, appeared very intimidating. There were already discontented local people who had no extra living space for themselves or their relations. The authorities hastened the Jewish immigrants through to Whitechapel with a sigh of relief. This did not mean that the people in Wapping were anti-Semitic. Many local Wapping workers worked in the Jewish clothing industry, made friends and married, and generally enjoyed each other's friendship. I've heard it said by locals that you couldn't squeeze another person into the local dwellings. Even the rats and mice were dying squashed to overcrowding.
A large influx of people came from nearer home, Ireland. The exact figures can only be guessed at, but immigration was on a huge scale. Many of the Irish left for America, settling in Boston and New York. The Irish were known as hard workers. They worked on building sites, established the canals, and worked on the railways as navvies. They were great road builders, and those who could not find work flooded the docks, particularly the docks of London and Liverpool.
At school, I learned about the French Huguenots who, we were told, were Protestants with a trade of silk making and lace. They were persecuted in and around 1685 in France, and over 100,000 fled their homes and came to the East End, settling on what was largely at that time an industrial area. They were very industrious people. They built their own houses and over many years had established their industries in Spitalfields, next to the City of London. Visiting friends in Stepney some time ago, they pointed out to me a building in Brick Lane, which they said had become rather famous. Not because of what it was, but because of the people who occupied it over the many years it had been standing. Erected in 1740 as a Huguenot chapel, in 1809 it became a chapel for Methodists. In 1898 it was converted into a synagogue, and then later it became a Bangladeshi mosque. This, then, is a record in bricks and mortar of 250 years of refugees making their home in the East End of London.
If Paddy don't go, then I don't go. If Paddy don't go, then I don't go. If Paddy don't go, then I don't go. The ducks would at a standstill. If Paddy don't go, then I don't go. If Paddy don't go, then I don't go. If Paddy don't go, then
Harry Constable,
I don't go.
In his own words, as told to Bill Hunter, was read by Christopher Eccleston and Ethna Brown.